Hey everybody, I'm Jaquaya Wilson, the host of the Unlearning of Child Welfare podcast. In this episode, Sandra and I continue our conversation with Sharonda, Matt, Melissa, and David on what we need to unlearn and why we need a family well-being focus. Let's dive back in.
I just want to have a little discussion around what is really required of leaders or frontline staff to make this happen.
I'm just going to go off of your comment there of the 20-something, referencing and looking at foster youth and then this magical age. And then we say, poof, you are into adulthood. You no longer need support. I want to just move that to a parent who's 20-something, who's young, who's figuring some things out, that doesn't need or doesn't have those supports that have been put in place. I don't care where you're at in life. You always need support. I don't care if you're 80 years old. You still need support. So the way that we are framing this and we are seeing the value of each person and attributing this time clock that changes things is, I think, what puts us a bit in the predicament that we don't see that each one of us is just on our life and we're having these experiences. When I go back to my own story, what I can tell you is that when I got sober, I was like 38 and I was about a 15-year-old mentally. And what I think about are all the people that came into my life and how they nurtured me and they saw me. They didn't see the 38-year-old woman. What they really saw was this girl, this child, and they nurtured me. They didn't say, you're 38, Sharonda, you should have figured it out by now. They came at me with so much love and compassion and commitment to my development. And they recognize that I had missed some things along the way. And so when I think about our leaders that are put in places to do things differently, the main thing is that we shouldn't be looking at the number. We should be looking at the experiences. And what are the experiences that have contributed to the trauma, to the lack of development, the numbing, the checking out, the stressors, all of these things that say, I can't deal with how my life has come and manifested. No one wants to be poor. Nobody wants to be in child welfare. Nobody wants to be removed from their family. Nobody wakes up one morning and says, that's what we'd like to be able. Those aren't the dreams, right? We all have the same dream for the most part. My question is, how does my dream end up looking different than yours? And why did you then attach it that I no longer deserve the same things that you also desire? And when we look at our leaders, we need to be very clear about the direction and how we see families. See my family like you would see yours. Invest in my family like you would invest in yours. And if we started to really approach it from that place, we wouldn't just see a stabilized child. You see a stabilized mama. You see a stabilized sibling group. You see a stabilized community. You see a stabilized society. We're not separate. We're in this together. And so our leaders need to drive us in that place and remind us and lead us to a destination of wholeness and of worthiness, and that there's no less than, right? The journey here really is that we're in this together and we should be moving and grabbing all of our folks and taking them alongside of us wherever we find them.
I have to jump in here, Sharonda, because you're giving me goosebumps as you talk. You're saying some really important things, especially when I think about it from a leader's point of view. So I had a different thought, and then I'm hearing you talk and I have a new thought. I think probably many people on this call know Bryan Stevenson and his work and his book, Just Mercy. And I think we all as leaders should read that book or, you know, watch the movie. It's a good movie too. What he talks about is this idea of getting proximate or just getting close or building relationships, really getting to know people's experiences. As leaders of large organizations or small organizations, it's really easy for us to get pretty far away from the people that we are here to serve. And that, I think, can be dangerous, actually. I think if we're not in relationship with people, we really don't truly understand their experiences, and we don't see them all the time for the strength, the hope, the resilience, dignity, potential. I would encourage all of us to find ways to get into communities where we serve families and get closer to the families that we serve and get to know their experiences and ask them. I had a CEO of a large organization say to me the other day that we're really good at talking about the things that we do as organizations, but do we know what families need us to do? Are we stepping back and asking families, what do you need? And if we ask those questions and start to build relationships, I think we'll start to see our organizations and our work differently. And
thanks for sharing that, Matt. I have a question for you all, and that really is, what do we need to unlearn or do differently to reduce that risk of creating something new in the image of the old? And Shrounda, I'd like for you to take us to church again.
The first thing is we have to stop blaming parents, period. I think that when we blame parents, that's the scapegoat. So we don't have to do any work. They're the problem. If they were okay, we wouldn't be in this mess. And that's just not true. So the first thing we need to unlearn is there's plenty of blame to go around for a lot of people, a lot of systems, a lot of the historical piece. There's a lot of blame. And I want to just get out of blame. I want to just get to solution. So what's learned can be unlearned, right? We start off the world as a blank slate. So everything we have that we've obtained, we've learned. Somewhere along the line, someone has given us the information. I'm hoping that we unlearn that parents are not redeemable. I hope that we unlearn that family separation is the answer to families that find themselves in a state of crisis. Propelling someone into a crisis that's already in crisis just doesn't make much sense, because then I'm just trying to get through the next crisis. When I really need to get to a place where I can mobilize, get my thoughts together, and get moving. When you remove children out of your home and you don't know where your child is, you just tell me how you would be able to mobilize yourself, right? You would be raised. Where is my child? So family separation is not the answer. Families that are experiencing crisis together can heal together. So we need to also recognize that we can keep families together, that we can infuse supports and resources, and we can get very creative about the ideas on how to keep families together. The other thing we need to unlearn is that my family's different than yours. Once again, I'll reiterate the statement that I made. We all have the same desires. We are far more alike than we are different. The problem is that we just try to assign those things. So then we try to elevate ourselves. And it's really self-serving, right? I'm going to elevate who I am and diminish who you are so I can feel better about who I am. Get rid of your hierarchical ladder. It doesn't exist. It doesn't really truly exist. When you really try to get down to the depth of humanity, that we're just trying to make it through this thing. And the more that we can join mission and force of really embracing each other, because walking through life is really hard. And it's hard to walk through it alone. It's hard to walk through it childless. It's hard to walk through it in poverty. It's hard to walk through it in homelessness. And the separation that we do to each other doesn't just harm me. What it really does is it harms you too. You just haven't connected to that. When I see someone who's homeless, right? That's not my child. But that's my child. Like, I'm connected to that person. I'm connected. So I want us to unlearn that we are disconnected, because we're not, right? I want us to walk together in this. I want us to recognize that when we remove children and you place them in a stranger's home, think about this. You place them in a stranger's home and you say, you won't be all right. And you don't even know the home you place them in. Let's also add that piece to the story too, because that's a hard truth too that we like to dance around. That you're rehoming these children and they're better off, because that's just not the truth either. So what I'm hoping that we will continue to do is that we will absolutely look at the information and we'll actually do something with it. It tells you a very clear path out. And what we're doing right now is not working. It's not helpful. It's incredibly harmful. It creates pathways to outcomes that are dismal, all wrapped in the premise of, we care about you, kid, right? And we want the best for you.
So if you are in church, we're all there. We're all there with you. I think joining forces and unlearning that we're disconnected, spot on.
I want to add a couple of things here. We have to unlearn that we have all the answers that will work for every family out there, as opposed to we need to listen to families. We have to listen to people with lived expertise that know their many assets and know their many struggles. We have to move from a nation that still has a dominant narrative that poor mother is to blame, or that poor family, or that Black, Brown, Indigenous community is to blame, versus recognizing that we all have a role to play in keeping children and families strong. Another thing that we have to really lift up is that children do better when their families are doing better. So this idea that we are a child-focused field and we can put the child in a different place or setting and that they're going to thrive, we know that's not true. We know based on science that's not true. So just like we know that early adversity can affect our health and well-being, we know that early positive experiences can balance that. So we then need to be about coming together to provide help to support families in communities to have those strong experiences. What really drives me a little bit nuts is that we think in the field of child abuse and neglect prevention that birth to five is the only time that relationships matter and that we need to invest in children and families when we know that prevention is lifelong, that it's never too late, that we can always buffer risk. We can always put in protective factors at each level of the social ecology that will help outcomes. But I think all of those together is what we mean when we say we need to be about a child, family, community well-being system. We need to be keeping families and communities strong and help them access supports when needed, because we all need it. Come on, guys, parenting is challenging year-round, but parenting during a global pandemic, acute racial and civil unrest, it doesn't matter how many resources you have. In this time of physical distancing, we need emotional and social connectedness to keep every family strong and thriving.
So I just want to say before David and Matt jump in here, we just heard the CEO of Prevent Child Abuse America say that prevention goes beyond the age of 0 to 5. And that is something I wanted to just highlight, because so often prevention is seen as something for only younger children. And that's how we end up perpetuating a system that's not designed for older youth.
This conversation is really grounded in why we should be having this conversation, not just this group, but around the country. We really need to be mobilizing, catalyzing this conversation about moving towards child and family, centering on equity, centering on strengthening families. I've spent most of my career in child welfare. And I think that one of the things we need to unlearn, in addition to what's been said already about we are not the expert, we have to listen. So those things. But I also think we don't need to think that child welfare is going to do all of the work that is required here as one sort of field, one system, one set of organizations, public and private. And again, this unlearning of it's just the work of child welfare to prevent child maltreatment. I don't think it is. I think having Melissa on here representing Prevent Child Abuse America was intentional, because I think we need to at least, you know, the prevention field and the child welfare field coming together. But we have to see, where is the space that this work of strengthening families needs to exist? Who are the stakeholders? What are the systems that need to come together? I was thinking about this a lot today, getting ready for this. Should we really be thinking about, why don't we have somebody from the criminal justice system on this webinar? Maybe that was an oversight. We have a long history of policies in this country that have impacted specific communities and specific families, largely families and communities of color, that have really been disruptive to communities. And I think child welfare is a downstream result of some of those policies. And so maybe we should be thinking about, how does criminal justice reform help to strengthen families and strengthen communities? So for me, I think that's a big one. There's lots of things that we can unlearn and do different that would help us not replicate the same old as we create the new. I think there's a lot that we can do, but I think really considering who are the stakeholders and the partners, what's the coalition that needs to come together to create this new space where we can do this kind of work, I think is an important question for all of us. So it's exciting to see everybody thinking about that today.
Chikwaya, what do you have on your mind?
Oh, my wheels are turning over here. I'm hearing all this powerful dialogue. And as someone who experienced the system firsthand, I'm super excited to know that we have the number of leaders that we do and ground floor workers really starting to imagine and see our families as human. All families experience crisis, and the child welfare system, the foster care system, is not just going to go away overnight. There's still going to be a need for youth who come into the system. And so how do we reduce that number? How do we really serve these families better? How do we really put aside our own bias to make sure that we can see people for who they are? I'm just really empowered. I feel great listening to this dialogue, and I'm really excited to see what you all go home and do differently. You know, every participant on this call, I be really eager to know, have you started the conversation within your organization that pushes us toward a family well-being system and not just child and safety focused? Children come from these families. And if we are making that promise, as Matt said, to do better when we remove them from these families, how can we help these families to be strong so that when they reunite, because they do need those connections to reunite, that they are in a better position than when we first intervened? And I just think that's really powerful. And I'm super excited.
How about we ask the audience? We'd be curious to hear from the audience about what is the number one thing that we need to unlearn or do differently if we're going to get to this family and child being system that we're talking about. Flood us in the chat. We see the flood coming in. We see the number one thing. It's going really fast. And racism. I saw racism. Mm. We have not talked about racism like we should have in this conversation. David, you started talking about your white privilege and how that has manifested. That is an area, folks.
One of the ones I see, culture shift from punitive to restorative. My, that is very powerful to know that we are looking through a lens of non-judgment and really looking to restore and empower these families. So that's great.
Unlearn systemic racism, stigma.
Sandra, I would say to that, I think it's really important for all of us as individuals in this field to do the work that we need to do around race and racism. You know, I think that's somewhere that we all can start and really need to and should start of, particularly for me as a white man in this country, I have to recognize that there are biases that I have that are just inherent, you know, living and growing up in our society. And I have to come to understand how those come to operate in my work and as a leader in this field and in organizations. And so that's an important place to start. And I think that part of how we undo racism, part of how we end racism is by getting to know people that are different from you. You have to start by building relationships. And I think that's an important step that we can take.
Couple of minutes, and I'm tempted to throw you all a curveball, so I'm going to do it. I don't want to move away from the race conversation too quickly. I think that one of the things that would be helpful for each one of you, Matt, you already touched on this, working on undoing racism. As leaders, how are you preparing yourselves? What's the work that you're doing personally to be solid in creating equitable systems and infrastructures for those that we know are overrepresented in the system? And anyone can start.
And before we do, I just want to throw out there that for our listeners, one of the big things when we have these conversations is a lot of people go, racism. What's that? It's not happening. That's an issue. If you think it's not happening, then that's part of the reason as to why we don't understand and respect the conditions in which our families come from that we serve. And so I'm going to pass it along, see who's ready to get the ball rolling.
I'll just say, I think we have to, as leaders, become more comfortable with discomfort and having these difficult conversations. I think sometimes leaders, you're used to having answers and being very solutions focused and going straight to actions. But in a racism training I was just in recently with Dr. Heather Hackman and my entire network that attended, along with the Children's Trust Funds, another big network around the country, she says, we can't just have a list. We have to have the lens. Mm. And it's as leaders, you go to action. You want to check things off of a list. But really, racial equity and equity of all forms needs to be the lens with which we hire staff, we retain staff, we attract staff, we implement services. It has to be in everything, who we give money to, who we support, what we do with those monies. So it really needs to permeate everything. And I think it is going to then be uncomfortable for a lot of us as we learn and continue to learn how to do this work better.
Thank you, Melissa.
I'll chime in here really briefly. And I'd say this is something I am thinking about pretty much all the time. And I'm trying to learn what it means to be anti-racist. And I would say for those of us in majority culture, we got to move beyond intellectually recognizing privilege and race. We've got to commit to no longer leaving the burden of naming racism to the few Black and brown faces in the room. And we got to own our part in how racism is perpetuated in the systems that we operate within and how we operate within them. And it's going to require us to make sure that everyone's seen and heard. And it's going to require us to listen a hell of a lot more than we talk, not to require people of color to validate their feelings or experiences. And we're going to have to start using those words that so many have been too afraid to use because they're the right words and they're the honest ones.
Thanks, David. I know we're getting close to time, but I want to definitely give Shronda the floor.
I'm just going to end with this. It'll actually just piggyback off. There's a lot of smoke and mirrors that happen. And I think that we really need to get clear about what the problem is. This isn't a funding issue. This is an oppression issue. And we have to start to really look at the policies that continuously drive the dismantlement of families, because that is where change can really occur. I want to just end with this super quick. I have this CEO, I'm not going to call him out, but I have this CEO, and I'll never forget when I sat in a meeting with him. And this guy was so bold in his language. He was unapologetic. And I just met him. I see him regularly now, but I was struck by his courage and his willingness to call it out. He didn't do the tap dance. This was a white CEO that is leading the charge and asking for change for families. And those, because of the demographics of America, have to be in this conversation, leading the conversation, seeking allies and partnerships, and driving this to where, if we really want to seek justice for families, this is really a social justice issue. And we need to be approaching it from that space for change to actually occur for all children that are encountering child welfare, because it's from racism to classism that are the drivers that are putting people into the system.
Thanks, Shronda. Appreciate that. All of you for answering that. Matt, I think we're handing it over to you.
Sandra, amazing job as our hosts. Melissa, Shronda, David, thanks for having the conversation, being bold in your thoughts and your comments, and coming together for this conversation. Thanks to everybody. We appreciate you.
Wow, wow, wow. Take a moment after this heavy conversation to ask some critical questions. What do you need to unlearn? What conditions are families facing, and how can you work together to address them? How do you listen and learn from families' experience rather than being overly influenced by their case file? The way we view families impacts the way that we serve them. Thank you to all the listeners and panelists alike for joining me in this conversation about advancing a family well-being focus. Please tune into episode 3 as we discuss how we can advance family well-being and hear from people across the United States who are already implementing concrete efforts from the ground up. Talk soon.